don't have a very long list of submissions, but we think that we can manage this Anish, so that we can adjourn for lunch, and after lunch, then we continue with other sessions of the day. Without wasting time, our normal procedure here is to first introduce ourselves as committee members of Parliament, and therefore we also expect likewise to be introduced to all our stakeholders who are here with us, including members of the Department of Mineral and Energy. So I'll start with myself here as the chairperson of the committee. I am Ngaba Ngobo. Ngaba means mystery. For those who do not understand other 11 languages, it also means castle. It also means fort. So it means all the heavy stuff. that's my name. I'm from the African National Congress. I have got here my committee secretary, Peter Paul Mbele. And then I've got here my assistant, personal assistant, Elizabeth Well. So whoever wants any other thing other than myself can talk to these two people here. They can help. And then I will go to introduce my members of the committee. I will start here. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. This is Chris Mollick, a member of the committee of the National Congress.
Temba Masaba, African National Congress. John
Nene, African National Congress. We can't wait a minute for introducing us. What's happening here? It's off? 1, 2, 1, 2.
Ke leboga ndula stilo lina la ka ke Dokase Adimo ke le lokola committee e ya minerals and energy.
Mo ndula stilo ke se fana lo bundisa ke le lokola committee mo African National Congress and the alliance.
Thank you, good morning. I'm Nomvula Frida Matibela, member of this committee. Thank you.
Mo Tswaledi Matlala, a member of the ANC and also a member of this committee, Minerals and Energy.
Eric Lucas, a member of the committee.
Lance Schreling, Member of Parliament for the Independent Democrats.
I'm Ben Yilenda. I represent SABDA, South African Mining Development Association.
Sorry, you are?
Ben Yilenda.
Honorable Schreling, you are very misplaced there. It's going to cause some confusion. Please come this side. I want to be sure where my members are when things are difficult. You must not always have a proposing a view, you must sometimes have a uniting view. All right, let's continue there.
Clark Johnson, South African Mining Development Association.
Oh, no, wait a bit. We are no longer, we're finished with our members. I want to start my week by members. But it just seems still that they are disappointed. I mean, there are many things that are not disappointed. Okay.
Well, I'm Anis Komrig, and a member of this committee and from the ANC.
Right. Before I continue with stakeholders, I think we should start with the department first, members of the Department of Minerals and Energy.
Thanks, Chair. Thabo Gazi, Chief Inspector of Mines.
Kakarin Damsa, GME.
Inet Babuseng, DME. Shelly Makhova, DME.
Rikus Van Rensburg, DME.
Okay. Right. I think in the absence of any further members of DME, then I'd like the stakeholders that are here to introduce themselves. I'll start from this corner here. And they might say where they come from, which organization they represent.
Morning, Chair. Thank you. I'm Anton van Achterberg from the Chamber of Mines.
I'm Frans Barker from the Chamber of Mines.
Thank you, Chair. Sita van der Voorde, Chamber of Mines.
Faisal Rendera from the Chamber of Mines.
Peter Francis from Randall Beckenham.
Declan Vocht from the CSIR.
Let's go further there, Young.
Fred Gorner from the National Union of Mine Workers. Derek Albrecht from the National Union of Mine Workers.
Morning, Zuwa Kenshapa from the National Union of Mine Workers.
Nokthula Ngaba from the National Union of Mine Workers.
Further that down there.
Mashile Maubani, Language Services Parliamentary Official.
Sorry?
Mashile Maubani, Parliamentary Official from the Language Services.
Philip Aurora, ETV.
I can't hear you. I just switch on your mic there.
Philip Aurora, ETV.
Digital Turf, ETV. Linda Ainsworth, Business Day.
President Elmar, State Law Advisors. I'm from the State Law Advisors Office, President Elmar.
This side, yeah.
Gershom Ramazan, from the public.
From? Public. Oh, member of the public. Oh, okay. That's good. I've never had a member of the public. Like, that's a good session. Welcome. Yeah.
Johan Bush.
Supplier. Okay. Right. I think we should then, we can start then our session. We know one another now. We'll be able not to call each other. So, hello, you. We call names, so we know who we are. So let us start with the first presenter of the Chamber of Mines.
Get the slides up, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
There we are. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen, thank you for the opportunity to give evidence on this very important issue, the issue of health and safety on mines. Thank you very much. It is a very, very important issue that we need to address and that we need to make improvements on. It might not be news to members that there have already been improvements. If you look at this graph that I'm putting on the board now, you can see that there have been improvements from 2004 and 2005 on the blue line. The red line there indicates the milestones that all the parties agreed should be achieved. And these milestones are based on international best practice. The implication of reaching the milestones by 2013 means that we have to improve by 20% every year. We have improved very substantially, as you can see, in the initial years after the milestones were set. Unfortunately, in 2006, there was no improvement, and in 2007, a slight deterioration, which is, of course, very worrying and very, very disappointing. However, the first 6 months of 2008, as you can see there has been, again, a very substantial improvement, an improvement, in fact, of 27%. A lot of that improvement was due to some CEOs deciding to get personally and directly involved in safety issues on mines. I beg your pardon. And some of these mines have seen an improvement of up to 75% in the fatality frequency rate. So you can see there is quite a gap that must be covered, and that is why we support the legislation that is before this committee today in most respects. Not in all respects, and we are going to emphasize some of the aspects which we feel should be considered. But we support the efforts of the department to improve the safety and health performance of the industry. We ourselves are also very anxious to cover that gap that is indicated in that graph. And if you look at some of our initiatives, then first of all, we want to look at some type of a vision around zero harm, and that is the vision that we are going to submit to our CEOs, continual improvement towards zero harm in the mining industry. We don't care what happens in the other industries of the economy. We're not going to compare ourselves to the other industries. We want to have the best safety performance. Some of the initiatives that we're taking, the first one there is the implementation of best practices. There is a lot of information available about best practices, but this information is not always applied. And that is the intention of this initiative, where we have seconded 10 people from the industry to the chamber, where they work in helping mines implement these best practices. And the topics that we're dealing with is leadership, the falls of ground, noise, and dust. And we can expand on that if you like during question time. The second issue is that of seismicity and rock bursts, which is still an important reason for fatalities and injuries. And we've launched a study by a large group of independent experts, including some international experts, to find out what can we do about this problem that the industry is facing. Then, for the first time in the history of the chamber, we are taking away the CEOs out of their work situation for two full days for a CEO roundtable to talk only about safety and health. We have international facilitation of that roundtable to make sure that we come up with action plans around safety and health, and that we can get the commitment of the CEOs to deal with the safety challenges of the industry. And finally, we also have a project on occupational diseases amongst ex-mine workers, and the intention of that is to make sure that the ex-mine workers in the rural areas have access to the benefits payable to people who suffer from occupational diseases, because it seems several of these mine workers do not have proper access to those benefits. These are just some of the initiatives from the Chamber. Obviously, we are working very closely with the other stakeholders on some other initiatives, such as a tripartite summit on mine health and safety and various other initiatives, but due to time, I'm not going to expand on that. How can we improve health and safety? I think the most important principle is that accidents should be prevented before they happen. It doesn't help to allow the accidents to happen and then afterwards you jump on the mine manager or you jump on the individual employee concerned, but a person has already been killed or a person has already been maimed, and you can't turn that around. So what you really need to do is you must prevent the accidents before they happen. And to do that, you need cooperation between all the parties. For one party to think they're going to change it around and make a difference, there might be a slight difference, but it won't be a sustainable, significant difference. What one needs to do is to find the real causes of accidents and incidents. That means that the parties should not, giving evidence at investigations or inquiries, they should not be afraid that they might be penalized for the evidence that they're giving. And in that way, one can find out what the real causes were, and in that way, one can address those causes. So that means that you've got to move away from this blame culture. Management blames the workers, the unions blame management, the department blames management, the management blames the department. We need to move away from that to a partnership culture. We're all in this together. It doesn't help to say your side of the boat is leaking. We're all in the same boat. Obviously, the second last bullet, I beg your pardon, if there is continued and repeat transgressions at the same mine, or if there's very serious transgressions, then there must be some discipline or sanction. Obviously, we support that. And that is also related to having a strong inspectorate. It's not shown on the graph there, but we need a strong inspectorate as well, and that's why we support the initiatives by the department to give the inspectorate its own office and its own salary structure and so on. The role of legislation is critical, but the role should be a balance between a preventative approach and a punitive approach. You shouldn't go too far with regard to the punitive approach. You can only achieve so much with a punitive approach, because what will happen if you only follow the punitive approach is that the mines will concentrate so much in just sticking to the letter of the law, making sure that they just comply with the law, that accidents will continue and there won't be other efforts to improve the safety record of mines. And there's a lot of other things that need to be done, and that is the purpose of these other initiatives that we've indicated to you. For instance, we need a total culture change in the industry. We need the leadership, as is happening in some companies, but we need the leadership of all the companies to get very directly involved themselves as individuals in order to change the culture of their companies. You need proper involvement of the union health and safety representatives. For instance, I don't think that they are properly involved at the moment to improve health and safety on the mines. You need the best practices that I've referred to be implemented. All of these issues you cannot achieve through legislation. You can only achieve that if you bring about a partnership in the industry to change the industry. If you look at this slide here, if you have a legislation that is too punitive, yes, you will have results in the short term. There will be an improvement, but it won't be sustainable. If you're going to throw out the partnership approach that we have had up to now, then, as I said, the mines are going to focus on complying with the legislation. They're not going to, at these investigations, make information known about the real causes of accidents. So you're not going to be able to prevent similar incidents happening in the future. And as I said, the mines will only concentrate on compliance. There are a number of examples of a more punitive approach, and that will be indicated as we go along. For instance, the protection of evidence is an important one. The sharp increase in the administrative fines is a very clear indication of the move towards a punitive approach. And we should be careful that we maintain this balance. And also the payment of a fine was subject to appeal and some of the other issues there. Mr. Chairman, before I give over to my colleague, I should just emphasize that in our evidence we are just going to refer to the most important issues. There are a number of other issues, some of them technical issues that is also given in our evidence. Some of those other issues that we have raised will improve the operation of the Act. We think that in some respects it's going to be difficult to apply the Act. In some other respects, we think that it is issues that need to be reconsidered, but we've just highlighted the most important issues. Furthermore, there are also a number of issues that we as Chamber wanted to raise, that we wanted to see in the legislation. However, we have decided that the legislation is so important that to raise these other issues might delay the passing of the legislation. So we have, as a Chamber membership, decided not to raise several of the other issues that we actually also wanted to see in the legislation. So we've only focused on those issues that the Department has raised. Also, in the spirit of cooperation and partnership, we've also swapped the submissions between ourselves and the NUM beforehand. So we might also make some remarks with regard to their evidence, and I'm sure they also might make some remarks with regard to our evidence. So with that, Mr. Chairman, if I can...
Just a minute. I just picked up. You are saying that there are many issues that you have not raised. You have decided to confine yourself to the issues that have been raised by the department. There is no other platform for raising them other than this one, and so you must not come later and say that. But we did tell the committee that there were some other issues that we wanted to raise. Because every issue that you have to raise, this is the platform. So you will not have an opportunity to go to the air and tell people that actually we did tell the committee that we went against some of the issues we didn't raise them.
That's quite right, Mr. Chairman. We don't intend to come into the future. We have a good relationship in the council, so we will be raising that in the Mine Health and Safety Council with the other stakeholders. And if we get agreement there, then hopefully sometime in the future, but not this year, obviously, in the future we can address those issues. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With that, if I can hand over to my colleague to deal with some of the details.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Dr. Barker. Chair, I've got the boring part. I've got to deal with some of the more technical aspects of the bill. Again, as Dr. Barker said, we're just going to rush over the more important issues. It is very important for people to read the detail in the submissions. The context is put much better in the submissions. The first thing is the protection of evidence. Dr. Barker mentioned that if you really want to improve health and safety, you need to get to the underlying causes of the accidents and the incidents. And there's now a new proposed amendment to Section 11.5E where copies of the employer investigation report should be given to the principal inspector of mine. Now, that's a good idea, but if you think about the consequences, if people know a copy of what they are saying is going to go to the principal inspector of mines, the first impression they're going to get is, if myself or anybody has done something wrong, there's an opportunity that I could now be subject to criminal or the other person to criminal or other sanction or whatever. So if you're going to incriminate you, yourself, and somebody else, you are going to be very, very reluctant to tell the truth. So although the intention is good, the consequences thereof unfortunately could have negative consequences for improving health and safety. If we want to be preventative and prevent future similar incidents happening at mines, we need to get to the real causes. So we are proposing that not only in the Section 11 employer investigation, but also in the state investigations and inquiries and in relation to administrative fines, that the representations made should really what we call be ring-fenced. In other words, that they cannot be used in criminal, civil proceedings and so forth against anybody. That doesn't mean you're taking anybody's right away. In other words, there can still be criminal actions. There can still be admin fines and those things. You can rediscover the same evidence. You just cannot use that document that was produced. So there's nothing preventing the same evidence from being produced again. So we're not affecting anybody's rights or anything. But hopefully...
Let me just intervene. You see, the department in preparing this piece of legislation, it has an experience over the last 10 years that there has been very little improvement, if any. And in fact, as papers have shown, there is clear evidence that accidents in the mines are worsening than improving.
No.
And of course, we'll deal with that, Tarek, but I think I just want you to hit that. Now, in the absence of any improvement, what would anybody do?
In fact, you are supporting my point, because it is not currently protected. So because the non-protection up till now hasn't had any improvement, we should really realize we're not achieving anything with them as they are currently. I mean, there are a lot of reasons that some of the employers delay submitting them and so forth, because there's the tendency for people to protect themselves. So if we're serious about health and safety, we can really get to the underlying causes, create the environment for people to really talk the truth, but without prejudicing the rights of anybody. There are provisions currently in the bill in section 61 and 63, and even in the current for the admin fines, aimed at that, but they don't go far enough. So the moment if you say, well, you cannot use it just for criminal or just for that, where it can be used in other administrative or so proceedings, you're not going to achieve the environment where people can feel that they can talk freely. So we feel that is a fundamental principle that can assist us in improving health and safety. The second issue we want to raise is really Clause 11, the inspectorate becoming an independent juristic person. We support that in principle, subject to some conditions. The inspectorate at the moment is really under-resourced, understaffed, and so forth. So something needs to be done to assist the inspectorate, and we recognize that. It is of paramount importance that we have a complement of inspectors who are fully in numbers and in qualifications, and more importantly, that they also spend their time doing inspectorate work at the mine. If we look at the number of inspectors compared to the number of inspections they have to do, even the current inspectors, if they were fully compliant, wouldn't get to the mines regularly enough. So those are part of the problems that Dr. Barker raised to this. Not only what employers can do, it's what everybody else needs to do, a cooperation agreement. Now, in supporting the independent inspectorate, we need to have an oversight body for the inspectorate, and we propose there is currently the Mine Health and Safety Council, that the Mine Health and Safety Council currently is an advisory body to the minister, that it can perform both functions, an oversight body over the inspectorate as well as an advisory function to the minister. However, one would then clearly have to just put in the statute some provisions regulating the relationship between the council and the inspectorate. And we want to reiterate, it's not the intention that the council should at all be able to interfere in the day-to-day running of the inspectorate. Inspectorate actions at mines and so forth should only be authorized to be taken by duly authorized officials of the inspectorate. So it will be purely an oversight body, and we think it's also very important that there's an independent chair, a part-time independent chairperson, like you have in corporate governance relationship with companies and so forth. And then very important, something that has served us well up to now is the issue of tripartism. The Mine Health and Safety Council.
Must be set by an
independent person, yes. A part-time independent
Sorry,
person.
Sorry, sir. Sir, I'm sorry, sir. Khawbayeke laba bantu bayekelekile ngoba manje uya no khawbayeke kithi okay
And then the issue, tripartism, I think, is the cornerstone. If members can remember when we had the original Mine Health and Safety Act after the Leon Commission, is the Mine Health and Safety Act was crafted by tripartite working groups and so forth. It's the cornerstone. That should be retained in the new council. However, we feel it's important that the people who are nominated by the parties to the council should have some expertise in health and safety matters. So there can be some requirement in the statute that there is some expertise in health and safety matters. And then lastly, we feel it's very important that the current financial support for the inspectorate comes from the department. The budget for the department at this stage is over 120 million rand. Employers contribute, in addition to what the department gives, about 40 to 50 million rand annually for research purposes. So it's not as though employers are not contributing, but we're contributing for a specific purpose for the research, and we feel that the rest of the financing of the inspectorate should come from the state. We are more than willing to assist in training, practical training for inspectors at mines and things like that, but these are things we've offered before, and in fact it has been used in the past, and one can define these things and agree on exactly what to do at the Mine Health and Safety Council. The next point we just want to touch on is clause 12, the functions of the inspectorate. There's a new, in clause 12, a new function that's been created for the chief inspector to grant, amend, suspend or revoke health and safety permits. And that's all it says. Now, in informal discussions we've had with the inspectorate, again, as Dr. Barker said, we've got a very good relationship. It appears as though the inspectorate is looking at something based on the United Kingdom model. Now, the United Kingdom model takes extensive resources. What really happens is you go to tell the inspector, defines certain risk work and so forth, and you've got to tell the inspector how you're going to deal with all those risks and so forth. You submit a program to them, and if they're happy with what you do, how you're going to deal with it, they will grant you a permit and so forth. So as you can see, that will require a lot of work from the inspectorate. It will require a certain level of expertise from the inspectorate, and more importantly, effectively, the inspectorate is approving what you are doing, therefore taking accountability and responsibility for what you're doing if something goes wrong. Now, at this stage, with the under-resourcing of an inspector and so forth, we feel it is far more important for inspectors, those that are there, to be in the mines, and for us to get the inspectorate functioning properly. If we look at the Health and Mine Health and Safety Act as it is currently, we've got Section 11, which requires the employer to do hazard identification, risk assessment, to implement measures to address the risks, and Section 9, which allows the chief inspector to require the mine to prepare a code of practice on any topic. So there are already specific mechanisms in the Act to deal with specific risks and so forth. Besides the additional powers for the inspector under Sections 54 and so forth, the issue instructions and so forth. So what we're really doing here is almost duplicating and adding a whole new layer of administrative stuff for which the inspector at this stage, we feel, is going to be totally counterproductive, add a burden to the industry. Furthermore, there is nothing about the detail under which circumstances these permits will be granted, revoked, even worse. Once you've got a permit, they can be revoked, suspended. So fundamental rights could be affected of people. And there's no guideline, no criteria, minimum standards criteria in the legislation at all as to how these powers of the inspector should be exercised. So not only do we have a concern of a practical issue about this, but we also have a concern about fundamental rights that are just added into a one-liner. It might be just interesting to note that Section 98.1G, I think it is, of the Act, currently empowers the minister to make regulations in relation to permits for machinery and all sorts of other things. So this seems in any event to be a duplication of powers that can already be exercised by the minister after consultation with the council. In these functions, again, there's no consultation with the council even envisaged. So we are very concerned about that. The next aspect of the functions of the inspectorate is, as with employers, I mean, there are really
specifically highly difficult, complicated jobs that have to be formed in the mining industry. And for that, people need, and by law, rightly so, minimum certain competencies are required. Yet there are no minimum competencies required for inspectors. And that's one of the major problems, because for the inspectors, they go to the mines, they're dealing with specialists in their field. If they don't have the required competencies, they are at a distinct disadvantage. And we feel it is very important, in order to enable the inspector to perform their functions properly, that there are minimum competence for the inspectors. The lastly, Section 54, what we refer there is the power for the inspector to stop and halt operations at the mine and so forth. There's been a lot of controversies currently or lately about the use of those powers for the inspectorate. And we feel as to say that they've been used inconsistently in different regions. Section 54 sets out a process that needs to be followed. In some cases, the processes haven't been followed and so forth. So we feel it's very important that there's a guideline on how to exercise these powers. Now, the statute currently in Section 55G sets out that there should be a guideline for these things and gives some minimum issues that should be covered in the guideline, but they are proposing the deletion of that section. And we feel it is very important that there is an empowering provision to issue this guideline and that the empowering provision should at least have some minimum standards. Clause 17 that is currently in the bill just says the chief inspector can issue a guideline, but there are no minimum criteria of what it should cover and so forth. And we've, again, it's going to affect substantial rights when they use those powers, and it has. And we feel it's therefore very important that issue section 54G or similar provision be retained. The next issue I would like to deal with is the administrative fines. Now, the first issue is we have got in the thing strict, in this proposed thing, strict time limits of 30 days within which the employer must respond to certain actions by the inspector. But there are no time limits for the inspector. And we feel it is also very important that if we're going to have these fine system, that these things don't drag out unnecessarily, that there are time limits imposed on the DME as well within which to do certain things. And so the second issue is the very sharp increase in fines. It has a relation to what we're moving to later on, but if you recall correctly, Dr. Barker mentioned about the balance between a punitive approach, the preventative approach, and all those things. And the very sharp increase in fines, the inspectorate has complied that when they complained that when they come to the mines, there are just lawyers waiting for them and so forth. With a sharp increase in fines, there are going to be more lawyers waiting for them. It's going to be more counterproductive. More time of the inspectorate is going to be taken up in these processes, unfortunately. The current fines are maximum fines, 200,000. They're proposing 1 million, which is more than double, or it is double what a court can impose in terms of the new bill. The maximum fine a court can impose is 500,000. So in an informal administrative process, they want to make it 1 million rand. Under the Occupational Health and Safety Act for criminal sanctions, the maximum fine is only 50,000 rand. We're not saying don't punish employers. What we are saying is that big fine really going to achieve what we're going to achieve? Furthermore, it could have significant cash flow problems for small mines. It could put small mines out of business. To give the inspectorate the power to impose fines of that nature, we feel is really, really dangerous without specifically also those guidelines that need to be issued with them on how to exercise these things. The act that brings me to the next point, there should be basic procedures with regard to the fines. We currently got Section 55G in the Act, which sets out procedures of what, when making a recommendation for fine, what the inspectorate should take into consideration and so forth. Minimum requirements. They're proposing to delete that and just say there must be a guideline on this without minimum requirements. Again, fundamental rights of people can be affected, yet there is a one-liner in the bill, and it should be, there should, when you can affect fundamental rights, minimum criteria and procedures should be set out in the bill. And that touches on the next bullet point there, that there should provision for guidelines to be issued. Again, the one-liner clause 17 in the bill currently is not sufficient. Section 55G, something similar to what is currently there, should really be retained. The last fundamental principle is they want to, there's currently a provision that the obligation to pay a fine is suspended when you appeal. And the DME wants to delete that obligation. In other words, you're now going to have to pay the fine even though you appeal. And we feel that really undermines and goes against the principle that until your guilt or innocence is finally determined, you should not be required to pay the fine. Again, the large fines that can be imposed could have major cash flow consequences for smaller mines, and therefore they should not be prejudiced until their guilt is finally determined. Another fundamental principle that is currently in the bill is that you cannot be subject to both an administrative fine and criminal sanction. Now, with the increase in this bill that now proposes you can have criminal sanction for all contraventions in addition to administrative fines, there's nothing that says you cannot be subject to both principles. There's just the one clause 15, the new section 55B in the bill, which really says the chief inspector or the principal inspector can either make a recommendation for a fine or refer it for prosecution. But that's not a guarantee that if it's been referred for prosecution, let's say the state declines to prosecute, are you now going to, 6 months or 8 months later, are they going to say, well, okay, then we're going to subject you to the administrative fine? It's the double jeopardy problem here, and there needs to be a specific provision in the Act itself, as there is currently, that you cannot, if you look at the current section 55, capital C3, there's a specific provision, and a similar provision should be inserted in the bill. Then the last topic I want to talk about is criminal liability. The first concern is previously under the system of administrative fines, most of the contraventions by employers were subject to the administrative fine process. Now, with the removal of that you can be subject to criminal sanction for everything, there's a distinct possibility arises that you can be prosecuted for more than one offence on the same set of fact. And we give two examples, Section 86 or Section 11, if you don't do your risk assessments properly and somebody is killed or injured under 86, it could be an offence under both acts, both provisions. So therefore, we feel that provisions should be inserted that you cannot be either prosecuted or subject to administrative fine of under more than one section for the same set of facts. Currently, there's a provision in the bill, in the Act, sorry, that allows you to, that specifically says section 91(1)(c), that where you don't meet a standard that you have put in your own guideline for a code of practice, but the standard that you have complied with exceeds the minimum standard that the DME requires from you, you are not guilty of breaching the Act. With the extension of criminal liability now to most of the other, or to all the other provisions, that provision needs to be expanded to cover not only administrative fines but also criminal liability. Because if employers can be punished for not meeting their own standards, but those standards are way beyond what the minimum requirements of the DME or the legislation is, it means they are going to put in their guidelines purely the minimum standards, whereas the whole aim is to encourage them to put in best practice. And we need to encourage them to put in best practice by extending that liability. Then the next point is, currently Chapter 3 issues deal with health and safety committees and health and safety representatives and so forth. At the time we drafted the Mine Health and Safety Act, it was agreed that these are labor relations issues and should be dealt with under the Labor Relations Act on collective bargaining agreements and so forth, that it is not right to criminalize them. It is now proposed to criminalize them. Nobody is giving any reason why that is necessary. By decriminalizing them does not, or by, if they stay decriminalized, does not mean you fall outside the Labor Relations Act. You're still subject to the Labor Relations Act and to your collective agreements, which breach of, you can be taken to court and so forth. We feel these are still labor relations issues and should not be dealt with in the criminal court. Then I just want to make one or two general comments in closing. On the news last night and on the paper this morning, I had to buy the paper from the hotel. They stand on the face. It's generally accepted there are major problems at the moment with the criminal justice system. The criminal justice system, from police dockets, from the evidence, the dockets that are going to the police and so forth, we need to realize that the fact that employers are not necessarily being prosecuted is not because the fines aren't high enough, because there are not reversals of onus. There are not all these other things. There are a multitude of reasons. And let's not focus on employers. Let's focus on any person who contravenes at the mine anywhere else, health and safety thing. The fact that we don't have prosecutions, we're not going to improve that by bringing in onerous positions. We need to look at the whole criminal justice system. Dockets that need to go to the police need to be proper. They need to not disappear. The evidence needs to be. Investigations need to be proper. We're getting back to investigations and so forth. There's a whole myriad of things. Presiding officers need to be properly trained in health and safety matters, in mining matters, prosecutors, and so forth. And there are a lot of initiatives going on, I know, from the DME side and so forth, even from the mining industry side in some respect. So we need to look at addressing the right issues. We've seen the NUM submissions. They want to introduce strict reversal of onus provisions. And I should just mention, is they talk about an evidentiary shift. If you look at what they're trying to propose, it is not merely an evidentiary shift. These are reversal of onuses. We've got a legal opinion on that in the time available, which I'm happy to make available on that. But to me, the real concern is by trying to increase these reversal of onus, all those things, we back to the blame culture. We're trying to find somebody to blame. We're saying the employers are to blame. They're not being punished enough. If you look at the legislation and the things, that's all what employers need to do, and what everybody's saying employers. We, as Dr. Barker said in his presentation, acknowledge that there's a lot we need to do and we have to do. But it doesn't mean other role players cannot play a very important, constructive, most importantly, preventative role. Thank you. I just want to hand back to Dr. Barker to finish off.
Mr. Chairman, the amendments that are proposed by the department don't change the whole philosophy of the Act. Yes, it does become more punitive, and we think that that might backfire against the industry. But it doesn't change the fundamental philosophy of the Act. And now the question is, are we on the right track or not? If you look at this graph, it shows our safety performance in terms of fatality rates since 1984. As you can see, from 1984 up to 1997, that period there was a slight improvement, a slight decline in the fatality rating. No, there was a slight improvement in what we have in our safety performance. Then the new Mine Health and Safety Act came into operation in 1996, and then there was quite a substantial improvement, as you can see there. Now, that is still not good enough when we compare it with international practice, which is the red line there. And that is why the milestones were set. And in fact, if you look at the performance from 2003 then up to 2005, there was a substantial improvement. That line there is a substantial improvement. And then, unfortunately, in 2006 and 2007, there was a deterioration. In general, I think that line shows that there is a significant improvement. It shows that the new approach of the Mine Health and Safety Act is working, but we need further improvements. We need to go down on, we need to continue with that line there and continue along that red line there. The way to do that, Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen, is to improve the cooperative and partnership approach in the industry, but to work together very, very hard to improve our record. And here I want to acknowledge the role of the NUM. They took out the workers on a one-day protest action in December last year. They said the safety record of the industry is not adequate. We, after that event, or before that event already, we said, yes, let's work together to improve the safety record of the industry. Many of these initiatives, I think, that are now being launched flows from that initiative of the NUM. And what we are doing at the moment is we're working towards a health and safety summit where we're going to agree on very specific actions to further improve our safety and health record and to make sure that we get back onto that red line, which is the milestones, the international best practice. To change the whole philosophy of the Act is going to be counterproductive. This partnership approach, this approach that we really need to change the culture, that we need to use the health and safety reps properly, that we need to train properly. We need to be careful that we don't only focus on the law and the letter of the law, that we focus holistically on health and safety in the industry. And I think that is the purpose of our current initiatives, is to improve the partnership approach. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I think it is important to just relate some of the procedures that are enshrined in meetings of this nature. Any member who is part of the sitting has a right, if he or she happens to have missed a point. There are points in meetings of this nature. There is a point of information, a point of clarification, a point of exigence, a point of note, and those are the points that are procedurally part of the meeting. And so if anybody on the floor, whether it be chair or anybody, if he has missed a certain point in his clarification, he can raise a point of clarification, and that particular point, he doesn't miss it, because at the end, it's no point, no use to engage in a debate where you have missed what people in fact were presenting. So it's very clear to know what people were presenting. I am trying to respond to a warning from a member here that maybe I made a mistake to get clarification. These are points that are enshrined in meetings of this nature. So it is very important that we understand that every member here who has missed any point has a right to ask for a point of information or clarification or anything, without interfering with the process of presentation. But also, members should know that there is also a privilege to chair a meeting. That is why you will find countries in the United Nations saying that we can't allow this country to chair this meeting because it will steer it towards its own interest or its block of interest. That is exactly why the chair is there, also to give guidelines to a meeting of this nature. So, although I have not given any guideline, I was just noting that I did not make any error by asking a point of clarification. I think these are procedures of meetings of this nature. I will allow the members to interact with you and see what exactly their input may be. I'll start there with the member, Fundisa, then Kombrink, Mashaba. I think you remember our procedure, that you record the input and then you'll respond accordingly. Then I've got number four, Honorable Kekane, Honorable Lucas, Honorable Matrala. In that order, Honorable Mlefe, finally. In that order, so there you go.
Thank you, Chair. The first presenter said that they do not care about other departments, but what is that? Their focus is basically on health and safety. Can you tell us which department doesn't need health and safety? Secondly, you said that they have a strategy to prevent accidents before these accidents happen. Now, can you tell us how many mine workers that have died in the past 5 years to 10 years until so far, if ever they have a strategy? Other question is that is South Africa the only mining country that mine in deep level? The other question is, they opposed to that, or what must be done to make mine companies responsible for health and safety? The last one, do they have any good working relationship with the mine, with the National Union of Mine Workers? If not, why? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, on your presentation on page 2, you're talking about you was doing a study on Rockbus. I just want to know, is the result of that study available? And if it is available, can the committee maybe also get some of those results? And are you using those results to prevent some of these rock falls and those kinds of things? Secondly, Chair, I just want to know what percentage of the total income of the mine are they using to using for mine health and safety? Because I have ideas the same as the BEE charter in the minerals, in the energy side, when you're talking about BEE and you're talking about mine and health and safety is normally 1% or 2% of the total income. On page 4 of your presentation, clause 4, you're talking about this will only happen if persons can talk freely without fear of landing themselves or someone else in trouble. If you can maybe just tell me a little bit more about those talk freely, why it says people must talk freely, and is it a problem when there's investigation? Can't people really talk freely? Is the mining companies force the staff not to talk? Jefferson, then also, I'm coming from the Northern Cape, this is my constituency, and we're still suffering there because of asbestosis. And the next one is we're also going to suffer is because we can't see it immediately, is the hearing problem. People working in these mines, and they're working with machines who're killing the eardrums and all those kinds of things. What are the chamber doing in helping us to prevent the loss of hearing in these companies? I think, I'm not sure, but I was reading it somewhere. Last year, the compensation mines was paying out was more than 230 million rand, was paying out just for the loss of hearing. And it's a lot of money. I think if we can start preventing some of these things, we don't have to pay that kind of money out. Because money is not always important. To hear something is sometimes much more important. And then lastly, the chamber was talking that they're going to have a workshop with all the CEOs to talking about all the mine and health and safety problems. But I just want to make sure, are you including the working class also, like the unions, maybe parliament, all those kinds of entities. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. add from the comments and queries from the members, I've got the following. The chamber has just presented to us the fact that they've been unable to meet their own milestone. There is a gap between the milestone and the reality. Whilst the very same milestone was also not very, it could have not been acceptable. I'm saying the milestone, if you look at the milestone, it tells you that we're still accepting that there are lives that are still going to be lost, but we are going to be trying to reduce them. But the target of 2013. Now, if you can have your workers each year and tell them that this year some of you are going to die, and this is our indication that we are going to lose 10 of you or 15 of you, I think immediately you would have to insure those lives, ensure them that if anything happens, those people are covered. But I don't think amongst them anyone would ever accept it. But this is an indication that we need to push more legislation to assist them to get to that milestone. You can see they ran away from the milestone. We may not say that it is deliberate, but on the other hand, as legislators, we get blamed for not doing enough to help labor to protect themselves. We're all aware that the employers, when they go into business, it's because of money, most of them, more than the issue of creating jobs. There are very few of those who will say, I'm trying to create a job here, I'm not interested in profit. And to me, I'm saying we cannot accept it anymore. If you look at this bill, it is trying to circumvent that non-compliance into your own plan, that this is what I want to achieve. It would be surprising if they could tell us that they are not meeting their financial target, but they're failing to meet the target to preserve lives. And it is worrying that out of all that has been said, I haven't heard the chamber trying to put more stringent input to try and assist us to minimize or to stop the carnage. I was hoping maybe that they would say R1 million is even too little. And that's not punitive. That's a corrective measure. That you must know that you might lose your business if you are not going to trade carefully. It's known that the mine giants would close their mines when there's no profit. But they can't close the mine if there are lives that are lost. You'll never heard of any mine that would automatically say we are going to close down because we've seen this death. They are forced. And that's why you'll find that they are not happy with the fact that when there are investigations to incidents and accidents, that the information be used in the criminal proceedings. It's because most of the time they will hide the information to protect themselves. The question is, where would you find honesty? And then how would you be able to gain trust? If you cannot be honest with your employer, with your employee in fact, to say that if anything happens, I'll be the one who will come forward and say, it was my mistake. I did not put enough money to cover the areas that could cause accidents. And even to go to the extent of preferring the labor relations sanctions, or on the other hand, even indicating that the court has sanctions up to R500,000, that now you would prefer, even that R500,000 in the court, they would still complain that it's too high. But I don't think there's any price that you can put on a life. The R1,000,000 is still trying to push them. I'm hoping that in the next year or so, will even increase that even higher. Because if you look at what the labor is saying, labor is saying now for each death that has occurred, there might be a day's stoppage. And how much money will be lost? Will it be R1,000,000? If there's one death and NUM says we're stopping working because of that one death, you lose even more. The country loses, the chamber loses, and the worst one is that the relatives of the deceased, they are at the worst. Because even that R1,000,000, I don't even think there's any cent that goes towards the family. Thanks, Chair.
Last one, please.
Yeah. Hello. Oh, okay. Chair, I want to talk about just some more clarity on this international best practices. I'm just saying that it is mentioned in very vague terms what they mean when they say international. I mean, they don't say in Britain, in America, for example, if you are penalized, you pay $1 million or you pay $3 million. I mean, it would be nice when they make the argument to concurrently bring that comparison to show us this benchmark, the internationally best practice that they are basing their argument on. Because that doesn't come out clear. I'm saying this because the starting point is that in South Africa, mining magnates have had a free ride. I mean, if you look at the environment, the dams, the water pollution, and the health and security, and safety, throughout the years, I mean, it started a long, long time, 1883. But all along, measures were not there. Because we know how the third world has always been treated. Extract riches, send them overseas, the cheap labor that is not supposed to be protected. Things are changing. And this is the other comment I'd like to hear from them. It seems like they are not for the inspectorate. And yesterday in the presentation, we heard that in comparison to Australia, we are by far behind Australia. In fact, Australia was surprised how behind we are in terms of the issues of inspectorate. Now, I can't understand why they seem to be against the inspectorate. Then they admit that the criminal justice system is overburdened with cases. And, I mean, it is not surprising that there should be a quasi-judiciary that specializes in the area that should be there to help. And the point is, in education, we do have inspectors, though we call them differently. Even spaza shops in the township do have inspectors who do come and check health conditions. If you sell mukhodi, that is right. They come and check whether conditions are okay. Now, I'm surprised that, you know, a quasi-judicial institution that will specialize and which you can cooperate with, you seem to be discouraging. And other nations, the international good best practice that you're talking about, do have inspectorate and have quoted Australia. I'm just saying that, they are not coming very clear. Ultimately, they come across as people who want to retain the status quo and defend it in the disguise of all kinds of excuses. And indeed, we just think it is high time that things must change in South Africa. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I said the mining industry is an old industry in South Africa, and we've been at this for many, many, many years. One would even say, why are we talking about this now? Because of all the experiences that they've had in the past. And when you look at the graph, you see this downward trend. I would, maybe if someone could explain what this causes, and then we could work on that, because it's a positive move. And we, if we could work on that positive, it will help us go further. I think there was an important, something said which was very important by the chamber, is that the partnership, working together. Maybe that's part of the problem. We have two opposites. You have the inspectorate and you have the mining person, the mining house. Mining house, more interested in making money. The inspectorate looked like policemen coming there. And if these two groups could work together and share the experience of the miners who were there, because the summit would not work unless everyone is at that summit. Everyone is represented there. Because you can get more knowledge from this here. And I think it's very important. Summits are good, you spend a lot of money, but what do you achieve? Full stop, stop there. We need to implement the results of these. The fines, they also say, seem to be higher than courts. I think the reason for the fines came up is because the mining houses didn't seem to be taking much attention. They looked at this as a work as usual, we'll go on. Okay, we'll have a chat. And employ lawyers, they destroy you. Straight away you come there, your inspectorate is knocked out. So you have a serious problem. And I do agree that if we could avoid putting these heavy fines, we must have something else in its place where we're going to work in harmony. I think I must emphasize this, is that this old industry of ours, which has worked so well, which has brought so much money into this country, unfortunately the people of this country has not benefited from this, is unfortunate. Because if this money was plowed back into the country, maybe we won't have this problem, because we must work together. We must work together. I came briefly to the meeting yesterday and I heard about the old song of no expertise and all this. I was very, very, very disappointed, because in the apartheid era, experience was used against us. Even now it is used against us. Our young people go to university, they pass, no experience. So you cannot be employed. So when are we going to happen? When is this going to happen? And the only time you get experience is on the job. It's on the job. And I can say South Africa, the majority of South Africa who were left out, must be proud today, because they've done very well. They've done very well. They're in this house here. We were left out for years and years and years. And we got here in 1994. Nothing's fallen down. The buildings are still there. We've passed laws. Not sure how, what, which way, everywhere you look at it, whether you think it's bad or good. But we've done these things. So let us get exposure. Let us get it. And finally, I should say, we can talk until the cows come home. Unless we put time frames, I think we're wasting our time.
Yeah, thank you, Comrade Chat. I think it has been some years, Chair, donkey years, sitting in this chamber discussing issues emanating from the Chamber of Mines, 1994 until today, we're discussing the same thing. The Chamber of Mines, I think, is the only one, I think, who can assist the whole processes. That is the only people, because they have resources. Every day they come to Parliament to present, they only change days and was and is. And it's the same thing. So I don't know whether, why are we sitting here discussing the same thing. In 2009, new people will be coming to Parliament discussing with the same people the same thing. So I don't know why are we here. So these are people who are going to, who can assist the whole processes. But suffice to say, Chair, there is one thing on page 3, project on occupational diseases among ex mine workers. I wanted to check as to whether maybe can they exactly unpack the whole sentence. What exactly, what are they saying? What do they mean when they say there is a project on occupational disease among ex-miners? I want them to actually unpack the whole sentence. Number two, Chair, it relates to, on page 4, there is a sentence, move from blame culture to partnership culture. I wanted to check with them, do they have a program in place to address this culture? Do they have that problem? The last one, Chair, is on page 7. I want also the Chamber of Mines to unpack the sentence that says retain principle of tripartism. It has set them well. I don't know, maybe my interpretation is that they've actually served them well in terms of them acquiring millions and billions of money. But I'm not sure. But it's them who can actually explain what do they mean when they say they accept them very well. Thank you, Chair.
What's the next one? Oh, Mlekfe, yeah. And then... you also want to say something, Matria? Okay, after Mlekfe Kreiling, and then yourself.
Thanks.
Now, we are still dealing with... I see there's someone there also raising a hand, but he's not a member. We are still dealing with... This is a question time only for members.
Oh, thanks, sir. This amendment that we bill that we're dealing with, it's not only about the injuries, it's about lives of people losing their lives. And one thing that does not come out clearly from the Chamber of Mines presentation is commitment. Because in a way it would be monetary commitment to say in 2000, because they are saying prior to 2005 there was improvement, but the decline started in 2006, 2007. And in his presentation, the first presenter said they attributed that success, according to them, to some CEOs involving themselves with regard to issues of health and safety. Okay, when you talk about the loss of life, and at the same time they were talking about around the table meetings of CEOs where one of the issues they are dealing with is health and safety. But at the same time they are saying some CEOs got involved, and that's why that success they were referring to, they talked about. Why should we have a situation where people would have a choice? Because we are seeing some CEOs got involved. Where is the commitment there? One CEO may not choose to be involved in these issues where people are dying, people got injured, and so on and so forth. In your document here that you gave to us, you are saying stakeholders reconsidered whether enough is being done to improve safety and health. There is this document that you gave to us, and that is, I think it's page 1 of that document that you gave to us. You are saying here, unfortunately, the trend of continuous improvement, especially with respect to safety, was interrupted in 2006. and even worsened in 2007. And that's when then you considered whether enough was done. And that's why I was saying commitment in a way would be monetary, to say we have invested in 2006-2007, invested so much. The department yesterday was saying there is a problem with lack of scarcity of skills. I'm not sure if, in your view, you would say some of these things, because mostly the accidents that we have in South Africa are mostly like man-made. They are not natural accidents that we have. Your commitment with regard to that, in terms of, do we have that personnel that is to deal with this crisis that we are faced with? Chair, at some point I liked it when they talked about partnership, the culture of partnership. But at some point you'd from their presentation, hear that it's like they are not yet there. And they were talking about the 42 million, the 42 million rand. My question is that is for ex-mine workers. My question would be, it's page 2 where you were talking about occupational diseases among ex-mine workers, the money that was committed for this ex-mine workers. I'm not sure if about the accessibility of that money. How do people access that money? Because it might have been 42 million 3 years back, and now it's perhaps 45 million because it accumulated interest, other than people accessing it. When you are saying it's like there is no close working relation with NUM, how do members really access that amount? Okay. The other thing, perhaps the last one, that
we are a bit running short, running out of time. Members must try to be at least as possible.
Okay. Chair, seemingly the Chamber of Mines is worried about the punitive action. I wonder if the department or whoever had to talk about punitive action because there was a problem or not, whether there was like non-compliance or not. And what are they doing? I mean, it's like the 1 million rand. They are mourning the advent of punitive action when families are mourning the loss of the lives of their loved ones. So I'm worried that because it's like in some instances we are aware that we had these accidents because of non-compliance of some mines. So I'm worried that when they deal with this issue of punitive action, it's like they want to avoid actions being taken against them, Chair. Perhaps in the interest of time, Chair, I had some other points that I wanted to raise. I don't know if you give me.
Thank you, Chair. I mean, you were showing us the graph, and you were showing us that you were making good progress in terms of reducing mine accidents, and that kind of stopped in 2006 for that last two-year period. What I'm interested to know is, have you done an analysis to find out what went wrong in those 2 years? What is it that has caused an increase in accidents in mines over that period? Because I think that, you know, as a committee, we're obviously very concerned about the increase in fatalities and accidents in mines, and we want to pass legislation that is actually going to stop this. I mean, that's our overall objective in terms of that. And so therefore we want to look at the specific reasons why we've deviated from that particular graph and put in place measures that can put us back on that graph so that it keeps going down. So I think that such an analysis would really be important to us so that we can make sure we capture that. Yeah. You know, the other issue around the punitive measures and that, I mean, this reminds me of a kind of debate that's taking place with regards to the Competition Act and people saying that you can't hold directors criminally liable for price fixing because then it will make it difficult to get the information out, things like that. And also, you know, we want a bit more of a partnership to deal with these things. I kind of use the analogy of crime in South Africa. On the one hand, certainly, most of the attention must be driven towards preventing crime. We don't want crime to happen in the first place. But when it happens, we also have to have a proper criminal justice system and proper punitive measures so that the perpetrators are actually brought to justice in that way. So while I agree with you that we certainly need a partnership approach and we need to be looking at strengthening that, I also think it's important that we have a very strong punitive measure to enforce the type of things that we put in this particular bill. And then just lastly, in terms of the ex-mine workers, I mean, I have personal experience in terms of the rural areas of the Eastern Cape where a lot of the mine workers came from. There's a lot of people living in those rural areas, particularly widows of mine workers, who aren't even aware that there's money owing to them in terms of pensions. And I would strongly suggest that, you know, the mining companies actually set up offices in Mthatha in those areas and make it far more accessible and actually have an education campaign to make people aware what they can access, because I think it's a real, real problem. I've noticed that in my work in those areas. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, on page 3, the vision, continual improvement towards zero harm. Then I wonder if this was a meaning, the real zero harm, because accident came back in 2006 and 2007. I just wanted to know because we once had a presentation from the CSIR that there is technology that was showing, helping the mines to know if there was going to be a rock burst or a tremor. Do they have those technologies? That's my first question. The other question is about, I don't understand this, on page 11, where they say employer could be prosecuted for more than one offense for same set of facts. In other words, if it's a first offense, that employer is not prosecuted. And the last one is about the health inspectors. Do they have inspectors in their minds or not? Thank you.
Mr. Chairperson, mine is to follow up to the question which was asked by other colleagues about the project occupational disease among the ex-mine workers. So I want to check that, do you have a data for the ex-mine workers? Because whenever you are going, there are people who are dying there, not knowing what has happened. I want to check that. Thank you.
Right. It's not a question, but it's more of a proposal from my side. You know, they say there is a saying that if you want your child to look after your garden, you must make her water the garden. Him or her water the garden. For mine, to operate with utmost safety, wouldn't it be correct that in this legislation or somehow in the ministerial regulations, that we say, because then that is the only guarantee where they can be made safe. That the management, the top management of mines, must have a routine of going down and checking, making inspection at intervals, at some given intervals, to ensure that safety standards are adhered to. I'll tell you why. You know, there was a company, Alken Aluminium. Alken Aluminium, when it was still run by the Canadians, they usually always brought the MD would be from Canada. And one of the things that he used to do, when I finished my school, I worked for that company. When I finished my trade, I worked for that company. It was a very good lesson. The MD, all the management, they started at 8. But the MD would come at 7:30. He would come at 7. And at 7:30, he would start the round. He will go throughout the whole company everywhere. And he will finish his rounds at 8. And then the company, all the other managers then come. But at least he knows everything what has happened in the company. Every day. It was every day throughout. So I said, this is pure discipline. He came at 7. And then he would take the rounds all over. And then, wouldn't we have a situation like that? To make mine safe, we need the management to have a regulation or whatever that management must take rounds at intervals, because if they take them in the morning, they'll only put measures safe in the morning when they are still going to go down. But if they know that they will routinely go throughout the day, their measures would be safe. They will put measures in place throughout the day, and therefore throughout the year, and therefore throughout the period of the operation of the mine. And what do you say about that? I think that is what we have to think about. I am saying so because one of the executive I discussed with, he said to me, you know that before these operations start with unskilled workers, in fact, the routine is that they must first, the engineers and top and geologists must go there and inspect everything, and they assess and give reports. And then the workers then ask you again, then they can start. And he says that you have hardly heard that there is any falling rock or other things that happen to those type of people when they go down the mine, because they put every measure in place that that thing doesn't happen. But then once the unskilled workers go down the mines, then those measures are no longer there. And that is why these rocks then start falling over those people. But he said, before the unskilled labor starts operating, the top technicians and geologists, they have to go there and make sure that everything is in place, so everything is in correct criticality for the mines to operate safe. So that's what they do, and they go down, they have this inspection. But he said that that's what they do before the operation starts. He said after that then, standards then are no longer adhered to, are no longer monitored, and that is why subsequently then you find all these accidents. That is why I'm proposing that if we were to have a kind of a regulation enshrined in this legislation for the minister to put regulations, that there must be interval routine of top management going down to monitor, because that will guarantee that mines are safe. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I find the discussion very exciting. I think it's wonderful to see the understanding among many members as to what is necessary to improve safety and health at mines. One of the issues that several members have emphasized is the issue of partnership, and I'll talk about that. The other is the responsibility of management. But I want to go further. I want to say the responsibility of leaders, because it's not only management, it's also leaders. Mr. Chairman, you spoke about the managers, the top managers need to go down. They need to make sure that the mine is safe. One of the purposes of the CEO Roundtable and of many of the initiatives of the Chamber is for management, we call it, to walk the talk, to not only talk, but they also need to do. And in your example that you mentioned, literally to walk, to go underground and to see. But I think what one really wants to achieve is that they should go down with commitment. And some of the members have spoken about commitment. They mustn't go down because the law says go down. They must go down because I'm going to improve this mine safety. I am totally dedicated and committed. One of the mining companies, Mr. Chairman, they did that. The CEO decided this mine is not going to operate if it's unsafe. He sends down his senior managers. He goes down himself regularly. If anybody sees an unsafe situation, they stop production. They stop production. People lose bonuses. The mine lose production. They've stopped production more than 2,000 times already in the past year. And it has shown results. And that is the commitment of the CEO. And that is what we want to achieve. They haven't done it because of the legislation or because of punitive or whatever, because they're committed. They really want to change what is happening at the mine. And that is what we want to get the CEOs, all of them, to commit. So if I can just talk about some of the questions. Member Fundisa asked, if we have a strategy to prevent accidents, why are we still seeing workers killed? I think what we're trying to say is that the philosophy should be to prevent accidents. We don't have a strategy yet. We're in the process of developing that with our other partners and with the CEOs to develop that strategy. Also to learn from best practices of other countries, of other companies, to get the strategy how to prevent accidents. And that is what we want to achieve. The member also asked, I said we shouldn't be worried about other departments. What I really said is we shouldn't be worried about other sectors. We shouldn't say, yeah, but the construction industry has got more fatalities than we have, or there are more people killed on the roads than we have. First look at that, and then we'll look at mining. We shouldn't look at our neighbors. We should look at ourselves. We should look at ourselves, and we're talking about mining. We should address mining. Forget about what happens in other sectors. Yes, it is terrible that our workers are also killed on our roads. And we're losing many workers on our roads, and that is something that also needs to be addressed. But it shouldn't take away the focus from mining, and that is the point that I wanted to make. The other question related to whether South Africa is the only country with deep-level mining, and I will refer that to my colleague, our Safety and Sustainable Development Advisor. whether we've got a good relationship with the NUM, I hope the NUM is not going to contradict me, but we've got a good relationship with the NUM. I think the problem that we experience is that good relationship is not always down there at the mine level. The occupation health and safety representatives appointed by the union, they don't always... No, there isn't always a good cooperation between management and those representatives. And that is something that I think we need to address. Yes, at the top, yeah, we work together, we work out plans and so on, but it's not always happening down there. As far as member Kombrug is concerned, the study on rock bursts, I will refer to Zitsa again. The talking freely, protecting the evidence, I will refer that to Anton. The hearing problems to Faisal. It's nice to delegate, Mr. Chairman. The question of whether the round table includes others, we are focusing on the CEOs for the round table because we feel that there's an immense role that the CEOs can play, as you yourself and many other members have indicated, that the CEOs must play, and we need to get the CEOs to commit, as Member Molefe has also indicated the commitment. But we're not leaving out the other stakeholders because after the round table, there's going to be a summit. And that is a tripartite summit where we get everybody involved and to take forward the actions that we can address. Member Matlava made many important points with which we agree, that it's unacceptable that we're not meeting the milestones. We fully agree. that there is non-compliance. I think there are instances of non-compliance. I think there are probably quite a lot of instances of non-compliance. And that is something that we need to address to make sure that there is compliance. But if we're going to bring in all kinds of new measures, which while currently we're not complying, then we should first focus on making sure that mines comply. And I think that is one of the objectives of our various initiatives, to make sure that there is complying. As far as the closure of mines is concerned, I think what we might not agree that we should close them. We certainly don't agree that we should close the mines, because the country is going to lose, the workers are going to lose. But we need to look at if there are unsafe conditions, that must be addressed. And therefore, the mine health and safety representatives, they should be able to also point out unsafe circumstances. They should also be able to withdraw labor from those unsafe conditions, without fear of being penalized for withdrawing the labor. And they must be trained properly so that they can identify unsafe conditions, so that in those cases they can also say, stop production, the roof hasn't got the proper support, and therefore we need to address the roof that hasn't got proper support, and then we will continue with mining. Hiding information to protect themselves, I think, is a very important point that he made, that if the act becomes so punitive that everybody just wants to protect themselves, then even more information is going to be hidden. And we're not going to be able to find out about the causes. Because Mr. Kreiling, for instance, asked, why did it increase in 2006 and 2007? The fact of the matter is, we don't know. We don't have enough information about that, and that is one of the issues that we're also going to address, so that we've got a proper system of peer review, that we can go to the mines that have actually improved and find out, what did you guys do to improve? Let's learn from you and let's implement it ourselves. And also, if there is an accident, we mustn't get people to protect the information. We must make sure that they are willing to share the information and that we can learn from that. And he also made the point about trust. We need to build trust, and that's why the partnership is so important. Mr. Kekana referred to international best practice. I think he made an important, very, very important point, and I think that we are also now starting to really to learn what it means, international best practice. We started in 2003 when we said the milestones should be based on international best practice countries such as Australia, which was mentioned, the United States and Canada. But we also now have more initiatives. Our seismicity study, for instance, involves international experts so that we can learn from that. The facilitator for our CEO roundtable is an international expert who is coming to South Africa, an international expert on safety, so that we can learn from those experiences. Also, at the roundtable, we're also going to get international CEOs to give their perspectives about what is happening in other countries and what can we really make, really do to make a difference. So I think that is a very important point that he made. As far as the inspectors are concerned, we certainly don't want to defend the status quo. We feel that they should be more inspectors, they should be skilled inspectors, they should be on the mines, they should be out there. They shouldn't be sitting in their offices working on bureaucracy and working on case files for prosecutions and all of that. They should be out there at the mines, and they should make sure that the mines comply. And I think that is the problem that our poor chief inspector is facing, because the country is facing skill shortages as a whole, the mining industry is facing it, and he is also facing it. As soon as he gets a proper inspector, then that person is poached, sometimes by international companies going overseas, sometimes by South African companies. We need to address that problem. We're willing to play our part to help him address that problem. We're willing to train the inspectors and work with him to address that. Mr. Lucas said, why did we improve? We showed those improvements 2003, 2004, 2005. And also some of the companies showed tremendous improvement, 75%. It's wonderful. How did they improve? What did they do? That is why we said that we need to introduce a peer review system where we can go and learn from those companies and where they can share with the rest of us how they improved. And that is something that the CEOs should do. They should have a proper system, not ad hoc, when I feel like it. There should be a proper strategy where we can learn from each other. And that should also include the whole issue of partnership that he emphasized and that I welcome, which I think is important. Not only partnership at the top, but as I said just now, partnership at mine level as well. The fact that people have not benefited from mining, I think that the Minerals and Petroleum Resources Development Act and the Charter is doing a lot to address that, to make sure that the benefits of mining are spread more widely to communities, to BEE partners, to skills development, to rural areas, in various ways that the benefits of mining is really shared and that the country as a whole shares in the benefits. Yes, the time frames are important, that we need also in our tripartite summit, in our CEO summit, to set specific time frames. We've got the broad time frames as far as the milestones are concerned, 2013, but the individual actions need individual time frames. I think that's very important. Mr. Matlala said that the chamber is the only body that can assist. I think there are many bodies that can assist. I've already paid tribute to the NUM for initiating the tripartite summit, which I certainly hope, and I'm sure they also hope, that it is going to bring about very substantial results. And in that way, the chamber can also play a small role in getting the CEOs together in also making sure that they come on board. And in fact, to say every year it's the same stuff, I'm not sure that is correct, because we haven't spoken before about this best practice implementation, about the seismicity study, about the CEO roundtable. All of these initiatives are really new initiatives. I think on the issue of the ex-mine workers, I'll ask our health advisor, Dr. Randero, to report on that, and the issue of tripartism, the remark in the documentation, what that means, I'll refer that to Zitsa to address. Mr. Molefe referred to the commitment that we want. Why only some CEOs? Why not all the CEOs? I fully agree with him that we need to get all the CEOs involved. We need to get everybody to really, really commit. And not to commit to comply with the legislation. To commit because it's the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do. And if you get the CEOs around the table, close to the media, sorry guys from the media, close to the media, but we can talk very bluntly to each other. And the CEOs can then say, I've changed my safety culture. I've changed my safety record. You should also do it. Then you're going to see real commitment, because then these other CEOs are going to be left behind. They're going to lose investors' money, and they will also come on board. And in that way, we will get real commitment. The scarcity of skills I have referred to, it is a problem that we're all facing, and we also need to address that. The skills also of health and safety practitioners, of first-line supervisors, we also need to improve that. The ex-mine workers, yes, I'll refer to that to Faisal to refer to. And the issue of man-made accidents, I think it is important to acknowledge that most of the accidents are man-made. And this is where some of the CEOs don't want to commit, because they point fingers. They point fingers to nature. They say, well, it's nature. Or they point fingers to workers. But we don't want any more finger pointing. We want to say you are also responsible. You need a personal responsibility to address the problems on the mines. And the problem, if you come in with a very punitive approach, yes, you're going to hammer the management, but what is the management going to do? They're going to hammer the workers again, because if the workers then transgress even with the smallest thing, because they might not have known, or they might have forgotten, or they were tired, or whatever, they're going to hammer the workers, and then the union is going to hammer management again, and then you've got the whole blaming culture all over again. We should rather work together, and we should rather come with an approach where we can properly address the reasons for accidents on the mines. Mr. Greiling referred to the the increase in 2006 and 7, which I've already referred to. His analogy of crime is very important. And I also want to use the analogy of crime. If you've got a high crime rate, and then you just lengthen the sentences every time, it's not going to address the crime rate. You need a holistic, as he said, you need a holistic approach to address the crime. You need the communities to get involved, and that is what we're saying, a partnership approach. You need to get the communities involved to address that as well. But just to lengthen the sentences, that's not going to help. You need, which I think he emphasized, this proper criminal justice system, and that's what we're also saying, a proper partnership. You need to get the CEOs involved, and you need to get the health and safety reps involved. And so on. Ex-mine worker education campaign, Dr. Randera will deal with that. And the other questions by Member Matibela and Member Nene, I will refer that also to Zitsa. And as far as the vision is concerned, Anton, the more than one offense, and the data for ex-mine workers also to Faisal. Could I hand over then to my colleagues, Mr. Chairman? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just going to deal with one or two issues. France, Dr. Bach has already touched on some of the issues. Thank you, Chair. I think the most important thing that Member Combrink raises is that, you know, what do we mean by people can't talk freely? I think Dr. Bach has already touched on that. It's when you are in an investigation or an inquiry, and either yourself or anybody could suffer any detrimental consequences as a consequence of what you say, right? And you said, I did X, Y, and Z, and you know that was contrary to instruction, negligent, breaking the law, or whatever. Or you say somebody else did that. You're already going to be loath to say that when those people are there as well, particularly, or if some sanction could follow. Even more so, if you know that report could end up with the inspectorate, with the prosecuting authorities, or worse so, even more so, for somebody who's going to use it in a civil claim against your employer and so forth. So what we mean by not talking freely is there must be no fear of any negative consequences flowing from that, so that people can really feel inclined that nothing will happen, I can tell the truth. The real purpose of this is not to punish anybody, but to find out what happened so that we can prevent it again. And the important point we made in our presentation is that does not prevent that evidence from being rediscovered, reproduced, relayed in other criminal civil. So you can still have a criminal or the civil charge or whatever against somebody. You just don't use that report. You can still call the witness and so forth. I think that's important what we mean by talking freely. I agree, it was raised by two of the other people, that we need a strong punitive element. The question really is, nobody has come and said there's a current, I mean, in relation to the admin minister of fines, people say, well, the fines are too small. But we have now opened up criminal prosecution possibility for all offences. The fear of criminal prosecution in its own should be, if you've got a criminal record, it opens you up to civil claims, all sorts of things. The size of the penalty is not the issue. We haven't had any cases where people have said, I don't care if I get found guilty in a criminal court. It seems as though the chief inspector is concerned that people don't find the administrative fine amount prohibitive. But that amount has now increased fivefold. So we just need to say, the real concern here is not that it's not working, or people are not saying it's not working. They just say we want to increase it, whereas the real issue should be, let's make sure that where we have prosecutions and evidence, these things are properly prepared, the whole system works. The punitive measures are there. The current measures are there. They're just not being used. For some other reason, they're not effective. And if we've said we've had 10 criminal prosecutions and people who were sentenced, and they are still carrying on. But the problem is we haven't had criminal prosecutions. That's the real issue, not the size of the fine that relates to it. And now that we can criminally prosecute for all offences, that deterrent remains there. Then the last point I want to touch on is one member by Tabela, I think, was said, what do we mean by that you should not be able to be prosecuted for more than one offense on the same set of facts? That does not mean that you can't be prosecuted for every contravention. So if you contravene now, whether it's the first offense or not, if it's serious enough, as Dr. Barker has said, for the less serious things, there are other measures how to do, but if it's serious enough or so for a first offense, on that set of facts, you can be prosecuted. If tomorrow or a week later or a year later, you take the same transgression on similar circumstances, you can again be prosecuted. It's just that for one incident that happened on that day, don't charge the person under Section 11 and under Section 86 and other sections, in other words, three or four different sections, that it might be offense under more than one. That's really what we meant by that, by the not a charge on the same set of facts. I think those are the only ones directly relating to me.
Thank you, Chairperson. Ladies and gentlemen, just to also respond to a few questions. The first is about the depth of mining. I must say, as a South African, I'm extremely proud to say that we actually have the deepest level mines in the world. But there are other countries that are actually becoming deeper as we speak. And here is the major opportunity for us in South Africa. If we can sort out the very difficult challenges around safe deep level mining, we could actually become the benchmark of safe deep level mining in the world. So we will actually be the red line rather than us going to other countries and benchmark ourselves against them. But it means that we will have to deal with difficult challenges around seismicity and rock bursts, and that is why we've commissioned that particular study where we involved the global and the international and the local experts. It was headed up by Mr. Bobby Goxall, previous CEO of AngloGold Ashanti. That study is being finalized as we speak at the moment, and our CEOs are committed to release the recommendations of those study, some of which are very critical of the industry and the way in which we're doing certain things, but they're committed to release those results and also to act on all the recommendations of that study. Coming to the question of tripartitism, And whether it served us well, we certainly believe that it did. We're working together in the Mine Health and Safety Council. We believe it's a very, very important institution. It's a unique institution in the world. We've been working very hard and revising all the regulations, conducting a lot of research, and also dealing with some of the very topical issues in health and safety. And there's no question in my mind that it actually contributed to that reduction in the fatality rate that we've seen since the enactment of the Mine Health and Safety Act by this Parliament. And the last issue, just on the vision of continual improvement, this is really just reflecting our agreement that we have with government and the unions, where we said that our ultimate target is to have zero fatalities, zero injuries, zero diseases, but that we're going to be improving our fatality rate at the 20% per annum. So that is a tripartite agreement, not something from the industry alone. I think, Chair, we often make the mistake when it comes to improvement. We think that if we do the same things over and over again, we will actually make the improvement. And that is not the case. Often it is a situation that you have to give people new or better skills. You actually have to do a lot of research to bring you new knowledge, how to deal with, for instance, the challenges of seismicity. And all of those kind of things are being done through the tripartite structures, the Mine Health and Safety Council. And it is, we are seeing the improvements, not fast enough, we all agree, but we are seeing the improvements. Thank you very much, Chair.
Chairperson, thank you. I'll be as quick as possible on the three areas that were identified. One was on hearing and compensation, the second one on ex-mine workers, and the third one on compensation and access to compensation. I think Dr. Barker said in his introductory points that prevention is where we've got to actually aim for. I agree completely with the Honourable Member who said that if we look at the hearing situation in our country, yes, the figures that he mentioned were correct. I mean, I could go even further and say that in a Department of Labor document that was produced in 1999, it was stated that when it came to health and safety and the cost to the country, almost 1% of our GDP goes towards health and safety issues. That would work out to an equivalent of about 18 billion rand, if I remember rightly, in 1999. So it's a major challenge that we're facing. Now, when it comes to hearings, certainly I think the emphasis has been about hearing conservation programs and how workers can protect themselves in an environment where there is a lot of noise. What is changing in terms of the best practice that Dr. Barclay was talking about? The change is towards emphasizing what we are buying. Because, we know that if you buy a hammer, the hammer in itself won't make any noise. But it's how, once you start using that hammer, and the noise that is emitted from that noise and the exposure that takes place over a period of time that's causing damage to the fine nerve cells in our ears. And that's where our best practice is moving towards. So let's take a real example, drilling. We know that for almost 60 to 80,000 mine workers on a daily basis are drilling underground or on the surface. The standard that has been used up to now is a compression drill, which emits noise at over 100 dBA. We know that there is now an electrical drill, which has many other advantages, both in terms of the amount of noise that is being emitted, but also in terms of electricity that is being used, amount of water that goes into that system, a whole number of other advantages that ensue. We are finishing some work as we speak on this matter, and the intention then is to take that into almost every mine where this best practice can be introduced with a culture. I think the other emphasis that was made, that it's just not about technology. It is how we change the culture of the work environment. So I hope that is sufficient. The emphasis, Chair, is on prevention. It is not about waiting until somebody has got 10% or greater hearing loss, and then, of course, very little can be done for that person in terms of providing those hair cells, those nerve cells back into them. So that is the emphasis with respect to hearing. On the ex-mine worker project, Chair, what are we trying to achieve there? I think there's two things. One is, it's about giving effect to an understanding that many people who have worked in the mining industry, particularly where there is exposure to silica, and it's not all of our mining companies and our mining operations that have exposure to silica, and where there is potential damage that results from that silica exposure, that can continue for many years afterwards. So, and hence our legislation, the Occupational Diseases in Mines and Works Act, allows for workers to be examined on a two-yearly basis once they have left the mines. Now, why has that not been done? I mean, the legislation speaks to that. The Department of Health has a responsibility for carrying out that responsibility, and yet research that has been done indicates that's not taking place at the level at which we should be encouraging it from happening. And this is why, again, and Dr. Barker commended the NUM early on, let me also commend them on this particular project, that we started talking about this matter, and now this project is a reality. We are about to start the project in Nongoma, in KwaZulu-Natal, where we know that some 10 to 15,000 ex-mine workers are living. And the intention, Chairperson, is that it's not a one-off situation that we're saying, okay, let's examine workers and it's finished. The intention is very much that the occupational healthcare service, which is based in a government healthcare center, will be able to provide the service on an ongoing basis so that workers can go for that two-yearly examination, that the two-yearly examination can lead to the outcome where that information is sent timeously to the bureau here in Johannesburg, where a certification committee will look at all the information, make a decision whether there's an occupational disease or not, and again, timelessly pass that on to the compensation commissioner so that compensation can take place. So let me deal with that issue. We all know, and it's been brought to Parliament several times already, that when it comes to compensation and the diagnosis of compensation, as well as the payment of compensation, whether it's to do with the Mines and Works Fund under DEMWA or under the Compensation Fund under COIDA, people, workers, ex-workers, wait too long. Any time, you know, the periods can be anything from 3 months to 3 years sometimes. Compare that to what the Road Traffic Accident Fund Committee recently showed from their visit to New Zealand, where in New Zealand, within 7 days of the fund receiving an application, the person is paid out. Now, all of us who are working within those statutory committees, and they are labor representatives as well as employer representatives, are working steadfastly to improve that situation. This ex-mine worker project has money in it so that both the MBOD, which is the bureau that deals with certification of diseases, as well as the Compensation Commissioner's Office, can do a consultation, an analysis of where the problems are, so we can improve the payment of compensation. And certainly we are aware with this ex-mine worker project that if we are suddenly going to make 10,000 additional certifications available to the MBOD, they might not be able to cope with it. So we might just increase the time that people are waiting. And I think that's why it's very important that the access to compensation services, as what some of our colleagues pointed out here today, the honourable members pointed out here today, that aspect is very much being looked at as part of the ex-mine worker project. There's another aspect of the ex-mine worker project, which is, you know, developing sustainable social and economic projects in the areas that we are going to. Because, again, with the work that we did with the NUM in particular on this, there was an emphasis that it can't just be about going in and providing a better healthcare services. So that is part of the ex-mine worker project. We will be going throughout South Africa and hopefully in time also Southern Africa, Chair, because we know that workers have come to work in the mines from Lesotho, Botswana, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Malawi, many other countries in the Southern African region. Just on the last question on where do we get our data when it comes to occupational lung disease. Sorry, Kay, do you want to stop? Really? Let me just say it quickly. The data comes from research. It comes from people who subject their heart and lungs to for post-mortem examination, and from the mining companies themselves. So there are three areas where the data is coming from. Thank you very much.
I'm very sorry. You know, this interaction was supposed to finish at 11:15. So now it's 12:30. Far beyond any over exaggerated limits. But anyway, because we are the main stakeholder, that's why we have been very much tolerant about it, because we want to do justice whenever we deal with this matter, because others are just concerned about, but you are the main stakeholder. You and the department are the people who really have to find the full flaw of this thing, and I think I've given you that. But just to summarize everything now, I think the department has also then understood. But as a committee ourselves, you have come out with very constructive proposals and suggestions. But why now? Because this has been happening throughout this period. The department is talking in terms of a period of more than 10 years of difficulties in this sector. And you are talking about all the roundtable platforms and forums that you are creating for CEOs, but the question from Masters Committee is, why only now? Is it because you are responding to the legislation that is forthcoming? Why now? So probably, therefore, the need for the legislation, because once there is such piece of legislation giving some warning of things, worse things to come, then at least you'll come up with all types of proposals that you have, probably, that look very useful. Yeah, but of course, the legislation as it is here today, 2008, it must have started somewhere there. That you must have known that they are already processing something like this, and therefore you started to pull up your sock. So, which is very good in any event. But indeed, even in the question of these, what you call the international best practice standards, to begin to look at the world wider than we have been until now, because all our international best practice is about OECD standards. We have never seen how, we have never looked beyond, you know, OECD standards or North American. And, but we've got a very big globe where all these things are happening. We do not take them as international. And I think time has come that our international must relatively be globalized and hemisphericized. Yeah, I do not mind. I'm just giving, you know, as a global overview of international. Yeah. And I think the GMA also will have taken note of the input from members in particular. And of course, I think from this, the GMA can then start instituting what we call a stick and carrot policy or approach. And know that those that do well, they get some carrots, then those that do not comply, they get a stick. I think that will only be the solution. But one of the best solutions is my proposal that management must also be part of going down. Otherwise, without them going down, standards are not set. Because if you know that you are also going to die, then you know. That's why the flights are very safe, because also presidents use the flights. That's why they have got to be safe. So that's anyway, thank you very much for your presentation. I wouldn't, because of we've run out of time, I'll allow quickly the CSIR also to give us their presentation immediately. Yeah.
Do you
Good afternoon, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. In contrast to the last presentations, mine is going to be concentrating on a very small part of the bill, and that's the clauses looking at research. So what I'm going to do is highlight those clauses, say why we do research, give some history of where it's come from, where mining research has come from in this country, and where it seems to be going, and
present some support for why research should continue, something of our own company's response, and finally draw a conclusion. My concerns are that Section 7 of the Act removes the permanent committees of the Council, and one of these is the Safety in Mind Research Advisory Committee, and it gives the Council the power to add ad hoc committees as needs be. And Section 8 is administrative issues related to this. But in Section 9, the Act used to state that the Council should annually consider an overall program for relevant health and safety research for approval as prescribed and deliver a copy to the Minister for consideration. And that has been considerably watered down to annually advise the Minister on relevant issues relating to health and safety. Now, to my reading, this is essentially saying that Section 9 is going from do research to advise on research, and this is a concern to me. Section 10 deletes the whole of Section 44 in the Act, and which has to do with the committees, and one of those committees is CIMRAC, and its aim, as stated in the Act as it stands, is to prepare the overall program for relevant health and safety research. The concern is that the bill is removing statutory support for CIMRAC. It's not... the bill is not saying that CIMRAC will cease to exist, but it places it at the discretion of the Mine Health and Safety Council, and that is of some concern. I'm not going to go into this in detail because I think everyone here is well aware that mining is important to the country and that it's going to be continuing in South Africa for a long time. The milestones have also been discussed. I'd like to pick up couple of issues here. The first is we've talked a lot about safety today, less about the milestones around health, silicosis, and noise-induced hearing loss. We've also talked a lot today about performance against those milestones, and we've noticed the uptick in fatality rates. What's also interesting here, this is data from the DME, is that injury rates have come down, but not as much as fatality rates, which might imply that we're getting rid of the more serious accidents, but that less serious accidents are still continuing. And we've seen our performance, the performance against the milestones is not good. I think what is more worrying for me is actually statistics related to disease. This is silicosis detected in autopsy on gold miners, and you can see that it's actually above 300 per thousand. This implies that more than 30% of miners whose bodies go for autopsy contain some evidence of silicosis. It's not to say they died of it, but it definitely points to the root cause behind what one of the honourable members said earlier, that you go into the rural areas and people are dying. And this is the evidence for it. They are dying. Dealing with active workers, there's a huge rate of tuberculosis, now above 35%. So also a serious health threat to the industry and something that we need to take into account. Now, I've presented these statistics, particularly the accidents and later the illness statistics, to show that there are serious problems. And I think the representatives of the Chamber of Mines have already said, why was there an uptick in 2006? The answer is we don't know. And I think the bottom line there is research is required. Just to look at where research, mining research in the country came from, before about the 60s, the 1960s, the industry was doing research on an ad hoc basis in individual companies. There was a big disaster in early 1960s at Colebrook, where 437 people died. Following that, the industry realized that it would be better to approach the safety issue in a coordinated sense. And so they established a research organization, which later became COMRA, the Chamber of Mines Research Organization. Moving on in time, in the late 1980s, the easy problems had been solved, the major problems. And we now started to move towards the harder and more expensive problems. So the value that people were seeing in research was starting to fall. And then we moved to the early 90s when the government decided that safety research would perhaps be better placed outside the hands of the industry, and they created CIMRAC, the Safety in Mind Research Advisory Committee, and levied a fee on the industry related to safety and used that to fund research through CIMRAC. This was at the same time that the gold price was falling, and it was at the same time that foreign exchange controls were being lifted. And the consequence of these last two is that the industry was loath to spend on research beyond what they were forced to, and also they had the option to use money to buy mines in other countries, which they hadn't had up until this time. Up until this time, they, Anglo-American was at one stage the largest, owned 70% of the JSC. They didn't do that because they wanted to. They did that because they didn't have the option of moving money into mining operations. They were forced into breweries and other activities. The effect of these three causes in the early 90s was that in 1993, COMRA was moved to the CSIR, and since then, company and government investment in long-term research has been falling. We're going to have a look at just how badly it's been falling. This is mining research funding measured in the rands of today, in 2007 rands. We look at the blue is the COMRA funding, and you can see the tapering off from about 1989, and if you look back, this is the period when gold prices started to fall dramatically. If you look at orange, that's the funding, the total funding received by the CSIR for mining research, and the yellow underneath it is the funding that CIMRAC has put into mining research, and I'll highlight those in a minute. Money is perhaps a dodgy way of looking at things because it changes over time, but let's have a look at staffing levels. COMRO had 700. At the time that COMRO was moved to the CSIR, we had about 200 staff. There are currently about 55 people in the CSIR who are full-time research into mining health and safety. We look at CIMRAC funding. Again, in rands of the days, in blue, in rands of today, 2007, in orange, you can see that CIMRAC funding went down dramatically in 2003, 2004, and has been picking up slowly, but it's still well below the levels it was at when CIMRAC was established. So funding for research has been falling on every front, but it is research that's led to some of the things that have happened in mining, to some of its great successes. The reason COMRA was established was partly because of Colebrook, partly because of problems emerging in mining the deep gold in the 60s. And out of this came a number of innovations that effectively enabled the industry to continue mining. The industry would have been closed in the 70s without this. It would have simply been too unsafe. We look at a great success in the field of occupational diseases. It's in heat stroke. Heat stroke used to affect 30% of all people working on mines every year. So a really dramatic illness. It's now almost eliminated. The very unusual cases where it occurs are usually coupled to extreme non-compliance. And that's because we undertook research to understand why heat stroke occurs and what you need to do to prevent it, and it's effectively been eliminated. Another thing is people are still killed in rock bursts. That's true. But the number of rock bursts that have multiple fatalities being counted as more than four has been steadily falling since the establishment of the Mine Health and Safety Council since the late 1990s. So research has paid dividends in the past. And the challenges for the future are immense. I'll just highlight a couple. The Bushvelds, the platinum mines, are not as deep as our gold mines, but they're starting to get that deep. And they are just starting to hit anomalous conditions. There was a recent event on one of the mines which the mines don't believe should have happened, based on their understanding of mining at depth, based on gold. So what we're beginning to understand is the Bushveld is different. It's not gold. And making the Bushveld safe to go deep is going to require the same efforts that gold required in the 60s. Another key issue around hazards is that they are often related to geological hazard in the ground, and typically these are things we don't know about until we hit them. So when you get to the fault slips and there's a big event. So seeing geological hazard is a big challenge for the future. The Chamber of Mines have already talked about the challenge of developing quiet drills, but drilling only accounts for a fraction of the noise exposure underground. There's also issues such as fans. There's the issue that there's still a lot of silica dust that gets into people's lungs, causing silicosis, and how are we going to deal with that? How are we going to introduce dust-free mining? It's estimated overseas that about 20 to 30% of industrial illnesses are now, or people are exposed to musculoskeletal hazards. Now, for us, these are second-order effects because they fall well below the silicosis and noise-induced hearing loss. But 20 to 30% of our miners are not enjoying healthy retirements because they have musculoskeletal problems, that they acquired while they were mining. We haven't even started to touch the tip of this iceberg in terms of understanding what's going on there. Finally, the last thing I want to mention is mining is often compared to other environments like industry. The key difference between a mine and a plant is the plant doesn't change. It's the same plant today as it is tomorrow. Mines change on a daily basis, and dealing with this dynamic environment makes them very challenging from a safety and from a health point of view. Some support in the past for research. The Leon Commission occurred after CIMERAC had been formed, but really laid the foundations for the current act, and it's recommended that research on health and safety should be funded by levies. The oversight to that research should exist with CIMERAC, and the CIMERAC should have research advisors. In 2003, there was a review of mine health and safety conducted for the DME, in which the people conducting the review concluded that there was no question about the necessity for conducting research under CIMERAC. They expressed concern over the responsibility for funding. They said it wasn't clear who was responsible for this funding, and as a result, CIMERAC funding was falling, and we've actually seen this in the numbers. And they recommended that legislative amendments be made to clarify this position, and I don't think that such amendments have been made. Finally, moving to a year ago, there was a tripartite in Darba on rock bursts and seismicity. Now, this is just one aspect, but I want to highlight the results that came out of this. They were around research and implementation, people and skills, and legislation and management systems, and I'm only going to talk about research and implementation. They identified challenges, a serious deficit in research facilities, capacities, and expertise. Rockburst budgets too small. Important questions not addressed. Mechanizations of in-scope processes given too little emphasis. Continued loss of researchers and expertise to the private sector in other countries. And their recommendations were investigate the viability of a Rockburst research agency, focusing on fundamental as well as applied research. And then they also recommended something around implementation. I think what they're identifying there is what we've seen identified elsewhere, that the declining research capacity in the country is having serious impacts on the ability to undertake mine health and safety research. The CSIR is aware of this critical need and so has been looking to establish an R&D organization that's central to a national mining R&D plan, and it needs to be massively rejuvenated. Finally, it needs to be key to the issue of skills. And somebody earlier mentioned young people come out of university, but they have no skills. Perhaps an R&D organization is one place they could acquire those skills and become more useful in the immediate term to the industry. This is what we call the Laboratory for Mining Innovation. I'm not going to talk about it further, just to say that we think that this can offer part of the solution around the research problem. But returning to the Act and the amendments to the Act, research is important to the future of health and safety in mining. I won't argue that implementation is absolutely key, but following implementation, we will only improve if we do things differently. We have unique research needs. The question is asked about the deepest mines in the world. We do have the deepest mines in the world, but nowhere else in the world do we mine in the same way that we mine gold and platinum in this country. So our needs, even if other countries catch up to us, we still have unique needs to satisfy. CIMERAC has been seriously underfunded. I know that there'll be debate on that issue. But the loss of its statutory mandate is a threat to the future of mining research. In conclusion, our proposal is the position of CIMERAC needs to be explicitly clarified in the Act. At the moment, it's disappearing from the Act altogether. And we propose that Section 9 be reworded or reworked to indicate that the Mine Health and Safety Council will still continue to support research and not simply provide advice on research to the Minister. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you very much. We've got some 10 minutes of interaction, members, if there's anyone who wants to raise some questions. Otherwise, then after 10 minutes, the process will stop, and we will have our lunch. It's going to be here at 1 o'clock. We are really running out of time. We have to try and speed up because we've got some very important processes of the lunch to deal with. members, we must try and be as brief as possible. And we only have 10 minutes. We'll start with Vundisa, Mataba, Mlife, who was it? Oh, Khreli. I thought it was another hand. Okay. Those three hands.
Thank you, Chair. I was so shocked to see the presentation on the wall, whereas we do not have with us. We just have this love letter to Mr. Ngobo. But my question is basically to what they have said, that they have shown us there on the wall, that they are prepared to provide with skills to the people or to the workers. Do they have any relationship with the working class? Whatever they do have, why would we don't see them on the wall? And again, they are saying that the research is important to the future of health and safety in the mining sector. Why they do not have any report that they have that relationship with the mining? I don't know either the mining, they are talking about the miners, the working class, or they are talking about those institutions there. Can they indicate to us what relationship do they have with the working class, not with the institutions or the mine or the mines? Thank you.
Now, Chairperson, thank you. I think the one thing that I'm noting is the fact that in terms of the document that we've got, I've been trying to ascertain the amendments to Section 8 and 10, trying to refer to the comments that are here. Unfortunately, I don't see it here so that I could be able to go along with the understanding of the query. But on the other hand, I'm hoping that when the department takes this presentation into account, they will be able to explain to us. I don't think the department would be in a position to get away or to do away with such a necessity. My understanding is that it will be there in one way or the other, but I think it will be more explained by the department in the response. But on the other hand, my worry is, or my question would be, would CSIR be happy if this role will still be played, although in a different format, or it's about the role being played by them? If we talk about research, if it's still going to be provided into the new bill, it's still provided to, is it a matter of them, or it could be in anyhow, as long as it's there? Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I'll be very brief. Just in terms of your presentation, I mean, you are asking us to change a particular clause in the bill in terms of the statutory power of this organization. But in terms of what really kind of frightened me in terms of this presentation is the decrease in funding going towards research, particularly in mine safety and in health. I mean, is there nothing else that we can do in terms of making sure that research funding continues to flow and is in fact increased for what is obviously a hugely important issue? Because you're just making a representation about the statutory power. So how can we possibly improve that as well, make sure that research continues in that way?
The final question. What is your... I had thought that matters research related to mining conducted by MinTech. What's your relationship with MinTech as a SIMRA?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. First of all, my apologies that you don't have the presentation. We made a written submission and only latterly opted for a verbal submission. So my apologies around the presentation.
a question around our relationship with the working class and providing skills. This is a difficult one to answer. We have had interactions with MUM in the past, particularly around training, although not recently. Our major client in this issue is the Mine Health and Safety Council. So our interaction really with all parties is through them, and it's tripartite, so it's government, labor, and industry. I don't know if that adequately answers the question. Moving on to the query over trying to follow the legality, my colleague from the Chamber of Mines has pointed out that I used the incorrect language, and that where I said sections of concern, this should actually read Clause 7 of the Amendment Bill. And Clause 7 refers to Section 42 or 43 in the Act. So I apologize for that. There's a question as to whether this is a concern about the CSIR's role in research or research in total. And I've raised it as a concern in the name of the CSIR because we are currently the largest undertaker of mining research that is not actually undertaken within a mining company. And so hence we are perhaps the best able to speak for the industry. Our concern is that the funding for research in general is diminishing. If the future leads to a lot more funding and it doesn't come from the CSIR, I think that would be acceptable. Naturally, we'd prefer it to come to us, but the issue right now is there's simply not enough research being done to have a meaningful impact in the longer term. In the response to the question on my right, is there nothing else we can do? I think this is the proposal that I alluded to here, is that the CSIR wishes to establish a larger body. We've made it very clear in our kind of drafting document for that we are positioning this as a start to the debate. And I think that this is part of the opportunity here today, is just to trigger this debate. I realize that this committee has far more to deal with than simply the research towards mining health and safety. But I hope that I've opened a little bit of debate and that it will grow from here in this and in other forums. And finally, in response to the Honourable Chair, the dividing line traditionally drawn between COMRA and the CSIR and then on the other hand MINTEC has been between mining and processing. So MINTEC handles research around activities that typically occur after the rock comes out the ground, and we handle research around activities dealing with getting the rock out of the ground.
Okay, just a follow-up on that. Don't you think, therefore, that you must try and integrate your research activities? I have in mind the bill that we've been processing on energy, which is trying to really integrate all energy activity of the Department of Minerals and Energy. Don't you think, therefore, that also there should be something like that to integrate this research activity for mining? Because at the end, you need each other. And you can't, once you create all these independent entities, then there's a very serious problem of coordination. Sometimes, even of redundance, you do similar things at similar expenses and so forth and so forth. I think probably that's a matter to be thought of by the department rather than yourself. But I think we must also try and integrate our mining activity into one conglomerate, well-focused approach. Now, thank you very much for your presentation. I think we will adjourn at this juncture for lunch. I think we should be back here correct too, so that we are able to catch up quickly. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
but they didn't see that. But that's what you agreed about yesterday. But I saw that lady there. I did not tell her that she's there. The one who was in law advice. None of my opponents. She's there. I saw her coming.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. But that is what we agreed yesterday. That's what I'm going to say. Everybody was there. And she's there and everyone was there.
Thank you.